hingehört und nachgefragt. Informationen und Kritik zu Fortpflanzungs- und Gentechnologie. Hallo und herzlich willkommen zu einer neuen Folge von Hingehört und Nachgefragt, dem Podcast des Genethischen Netzwerks. Heute geht es um Philanthrokapitalismus. Immer mehr Superreiche investieren ihr Vermögen in gemeinnützige Stiftungen. Allerdings ist die Wohltätigkeitsarbeit nicht der einzige Grund dafür. Vielmehr scheint es sich um eine neue Strategie zu handeln, um Eigeninteressen in der Politik, Wirtschaft sowie Forschung durchzusetzen. In diesem Podcast beschreibt der US-amerikanische Investigativjournalist Tim Schwab anhand des Beispiels der Bill und Melinda Gates Stiftung, wie Millionäre auf undemokratische Art und Weise zunehmend im politischen Geschehen mitmischen. Welche Interessen verfolgt der Tech-Millionär und warum stellt sich das als so problematisch dar? Welche Bereiche sind davon besonders betroffen? Diese und andere Fragen beantwortet unser Gast in dem folgenden Interview, das diesmal komplett auf Englisch ist. Eine deutsche Übersetzung des Interviews könnt ihr aber in der aktuellen Ausgabe unseres Fachmagazins bzw. auf unserer Webseite nachlesen. Den Link dazu findet ihr in den Shownotes. Viel Spaß beim Hören.
Dear Tim, thanks for being here on the podcast. For all that don't know you, maybe you can introduce yourself and also tell us a bit about what you're currently or have been currently working on.
Sure. Thanks for having me, Pascal. I really appreciate the opportunity. A few years ago, I started looking into the Gates Foundation, which to me at the time, it seemed like one of the biggest stories that other journalists had missed. You have this phenomenally rich man, Bill Gates. Today, he's worth $130 billion. You have he runs a very powerful private foundation, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, whose endowment today is $67 billion. So he has a great deal of money, but also a great deal of influence on the world stage. He's traveling around the world, meeting with government leaders, shaping priorities, shaping the agenda of governments, and also shaping how tax dollars are spent. So it seems like, you know, in the United States, the way they teach journalists is that your job is to comfort the afflicted and to afflict the comforted. So if your mission as a journalist is to afflict the comforted, there are very few people on earth more comfortable in terms of the great wealth and the privileges and power and influence that someone like Bill Gates has. So why aren't journalists more assiduously, more aggressively scrutinizing Bill Gates and the Gates Foundation? And this is what I'm arguing in the book, is that the Gates Foundation is not a charity. It's not this unimpeachable philanthropy that we've been made to believe, but it is a powerful political actor. It's shaping all kinds of public policies, from public health to public education, that most of us would hope would be organized in a public and democratic manner. But through philanthropy, it's kind of an exercise of money in politics. It's the richest guy gets the loudest voice. Bill Gates is not donating money. He's buying influence. He's buying a seat at the decision-making table that's able to remake all manner of public policies that really affect all of us. Even in rich nations, you see Gates exercising influence. So it's an important story, I think, that a lot of journalists have missed. And after I think 3-4 years of reporting the Gates Foundation, I expanded my reporting into this new book, The Bill Gates Problem, which is now out and even available in the German language.
Yes, amazing. You're already foreshadowing a bit into the next question about the term foundation itself. I would say that most people have a really positive association, but you already said that it's not only about charity. Our work here at the Genetic Network is based on a foundation, and we try to make as much of our work publicly available because we depend on donations on part. Then my question to you would be, how collaborative was the Gates Foundation regarding your work, your research? How easy was it to collect information on it?
It was not easy. But before I get into the difficulties of reporting this book, I do want to say that, you know, I don't have an argument against charity in and of itself. Probably everyone listening to this podcast engages in charity as a giver or as a taker. And, you know, my first reporting on the Gates Foundation was funded through a very small journalism foundation that gives away money for one reason, which is to support journalism for the sake of journalism. You know, it's very different practice than, for example, the Gates Foundation, which also puts money into journalism, hundreds of millions of dollars into journalism, in fact. And its ambition is not to support journalism for the sake of journalism, but Gates funds journalism to amplify and elevate its agenda, its priorities, if not also its brand and its legacy. So to your question, how much did the Gates Foundation engage with me? Before I wrote my first article on the Gates Foundation or established myself as a journalist who would put a critical lens to Gates, I got very little engagement from the Gates Foundation. I was never able to secure an interview, even before I ever published the first article. And this isn't a unique experience to me. I've talked to other journalists and academic researchers who have found the same experience. When you come to the Gates Foundation, you say, you know, you are a nonprofit, humanitarian, philanthropic body. There's a lot of critics around your work. Can we discuss this criticism? Can we discuss how you work internally? Can we discuss these criticisms about the lack of transparency and accountability at the Gates Foundation? And you're not going to get very far with the foundation in that way. You know, again, this is a $67 billion institution. It is very interested in conserving and expanding the power it has. It's not interested in debating its work. It's not interested in engaging with criticisms. It's really interested in advancing its own priorities and agenda and building up its reputation. At a point, the Gates Foundation simply stopped responding to all emails that I would send them. And again, this is not a really unique experience. I think you'll find many, many different testimonials from other researchers, scholars, and reporters who have tried to look critically at the Gates Foundation. They find a similar lack of engagement and transparency. And so I will just say real quickly that in writing this book, I am standing on the shoulders of giants. You know, for the last two decades, there have always been scholars and reporters who have put a critical lens to the Gates Foundation. They haven't had the same, they haven't had the attention that they deserve, especially in the mainstream media, but those voices are out there. And there, of course, there are many, many more critics who don't raise their voice, who aren't speaking out or speaking up, but who have still, who know the Gates Foundation well and who are highly critical of its work.
One of the most fascinating parts of the book for me was on how foundations in general work, how they are bound to certain regulations in the US. Could you maybe elaborate on how foundations work, or maybe how the Gates Foundation works, where the money comes from, how it handles money, and so on?
Right. So in the United States, it is incorporated as a nonprofit private foundation when there are very few rules and regulations governing how it operates. One of the only rules is it has to give away 5% of its endowment every year, which maybe sounds like a lot when you're looking at $67 billion. And in terms of sheer numbers, it is. But in a lot of other ways, I think if you look at it fairly, it's really not a great sum of money. I mean, I guess it's helpful to take a step back and to think about the way it really works. Bill Gates donates money from his private wealth to his private foundation. So he hasn't given up control of the money. He hasn't donated it to other people. He's donated it to his own foundation, where he continues to manage how the money is spent. But in doing so, he gets massive personal tax breaks because of the way the US tax code is written. So he moves all this money from his private bank account to the Gates Foundation's bank account. He hasn't relinquished control over it. He still controls the money, but he's gotten major personal tax benefits. Now that money sits in the Gates Foundation's bank account, where it's invested in anything and everything. In most years, it's generating billions of dollars in investment income. Again, this is tax-free income. So, you know, I think there's some years even when the Gates Foundation is making more money through investment income than it is giving away in charity. You know, and this is one reason why the Gates Foundation is growing over time. You would expect an institution in the business of giving money away to be sunsetting, for its reserves and its endowment to be diminishing over the time. But you find the exact opposite with the Gates Foundation, where it's getting richer over time. It's getting more money. And this, of course, raises long-term questions about the political influence of the Gates Foundation as it takes an increasingly institutional role in public policy as it's becoming more rich and more powerful. That really raises very important questions about democracy, about, you know, the many billionaires that are coming next that are going to follow in Bill Gates' footsteps.
And you said that there are like this tax breaks. There's a lot of money, but then again, where does the money flow to? Where does Bill Gates or the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation invest money to?
In terms of the endowment, there are investments that are anything and everything. And over years, journalists have actually done a good job showing they're having investments in private prisons and fast food companies and all these industries that, you know, the foundation is positioned to make money from products, practices, industries that, you know, many would say are harming the very poor people that the Gates Foundation intends or aims to help. So there's a kind of conflicting mission or conflicting ethics there. In terms of where the Gates Foundation gives money, some of the largest recipients of the Gates Foundation's funding are organizations where the Gates Foundation sits on the board of directors. So the Gates Foundation, I think the top destination of Gates Foundation funding is a vaccine distribution procurement organization called Gavi in Switzerland. And the Gates Foundation sits on the board of directors. So, you know, you have Bill Gates donating money from his private wealth to his private foundation, where he continues to exercise control over it. It then goes to an outside organization where the Gates Foundation sits on the board of directors. At a point, you have to say, is this charity? Is this giving money away? If at every step you're continuing to have a role to exercising influence over how those dollars are spent. So there's a lot of ways, once you start to peel back the layers of the onion, it really strains the common definition of charity or the common definition of philanthropy, the way the Gates Foundation operates.
What would you think that, I mean, Bill Gates was like this Microsoft guy, which is a strategy he took from this business into the Gates Foundation?
Yeah, I think it is important. We've either forgotten or forgiven Bill Gates' first chapter as this software technologist, this, you know, the head of Microsoft. And we've imagined that he was this cold-hearted capitalist, and now he's this kind-hearted philanthropist, and that he's really changed his character, his personality, and his ambitions. And that's really, I think, that's really a miscue. That's not at all what happened. Bill Gates today remains the exact same person who ran Microsoft. And you see that in the values and the sensibilities and the approaches he brings to the Gates Foundation. In the same way that Bill Gates is unapologetic for the corporate practices of Microsoft, even though it's widely viewed as a destructive monopoly, you know, Bill Gates would say that it helped usher in a computer revolution, you know, that drove all kinds of social progress. And so, you know, Bill Gates brings that same ethos to his philanthropic work. For example, it's work with pharmaceuticals, where it's working with and through the largest multinational pharmaceutical companies to try to bring new drugs and vaccines to the marketplace. So it's very much a classically neoliberal sensibility. It's about market-based solutions. It's about corporate power. It's about technology as a solution to everything. The importance of intellectual property at all costs to protect and preserve intellectual property protections. So, I mean, the other way that the Gates Foundation is like Microsoft is that it today is hounded by allegations of exercising bullying monopoly power. So, you know, Bill Gates launched the Gates Foundation at the height of a major public relations crisis as Microsoft was involved in, you know, antitrust legal cases about its stifling industry and stifling innovation. You know, at the turn of the millennium, Bill Gates was one of the most embattled business public figures on earth. People were throwing pies in his face. The TV show The Simpsons was ridiculing Bill Gates. So he really needed a marketing or PR change, which is what the Gates Foundation delivered to him. But, you know, again, these allegations of monopoly power continue to hound the Gates Foundation, where it has so much money that it can go into a given field or a given corner of a field and to a great degree take it over. It can become the most powerful funder and a very powerful influencer of how those fields work, especially for, you know, the so-called diseases of the poor, where, you know, pharmaceutical industry isn't going to invest a lot of money into these diseases because they can't make a lot of money. So there isn't a lot of money to support these. So the Gates Foundation can go into these areas with its money, and it can very quickly become the most powerful voice in that field, the most powerful shaper and influencer. And, you know, it raises a lot of questions about science, about research, and about also about how effective it actually is in all of this work. In many of the areas that the Gates Foundation works, it stands accused of doing more harm than good. And after writing the book, that's certainly the conclusion that I came up with, that, you know, I don't doubt that Bill Gates is well-meaning in the sense that he really believes that he's helping the world. The problem is he's helping the world the only way he knows how, which is by taking control. So he's forcing his ideas and his solutions in a fundamentally anti-democratic way, in ways that are counterproductive, that create all kinds of collateral damage and opportunity costs, and that are ultimately doing more harm than good. And it's time now to consider the counterfactuals and the alternatives and a different point of view on the Gates Foundation story.
I myself have been working as a researcher, therefore I know that there are a lot of fundings coming in from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And as you were saying, they put a lot of money in, for example, the disease of the poor. Where do you see the problem related to the research funding coming from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation?
One thing I did in the book is I reached out to, so a kind of quirk of the Gates Foundation is that it's donating money to private companies. And for a lot of people, that might sound or seem counterintuitive. You know, the foundation is donating money to Pfizer, for example. Very questionable, again, strains the common definition of charity. Why would we give tax benefits to Bill Gates or the Gates Foundation for donating money to a massive, major multinational pharmaceutical company? Bigger picture, you know, if you are thinking about access to medicine, the people can't afford access to life-saving medicine. The people are dying because they can't afford access. Is Big Pharma really a humanitarian partner in solving this problem, or are they the obstacle? So, you know, the Gates Foundation, that's been one of its biggest impacts, is working so closely with the pharmaceutical industry, especially Big Pharma, to sort of legitimize and normalize or even present them as humanitarian partners or humanitarian bodies. In a lot of ways, they're standing in the pathway of strategies that would be more egalitarian, that would challenge Big Pharma's power in the marketplace, the monopoly power that they often exercise, which in practice means the life-saving medicines they sell are too expensive for poor people to access. And, you know, Bill Gates and the Gates Foundation, they have a number of projects, they call them market-shaping projects, that try and get around this market failure, that try and negotiate prices with Big Pharma and to do bulk purchasing. But, you know, and that is one way to tackle this problem, but it's not the only way. And, you know, if you look back on the history of its work, it's arguably like the least efficient way, certainly the least just way in terms of access to medicine.
So you would also say that there, how I heard it out of what you just were saying, that there's a link to a form of colonialism in the way of the Gates Foundation working?
I think that's a fair assessment. One thing I did in my reporting was I looked at every charitable grant the Gates Foundation had ever given away, and that's more than 30,000 grants. And once you have all of those grants in a spreadsheet, you can sort of sort it and filter it and code it, and you can sort of start to follow the money to some extent. I mean, there are major transparency problems at the Gates Foundation to limit what we can see, even the flows of money. But from everything it has published, you can see that something around 90% of its charitable dollars go to rich nations. And that should be counterintuitive, because if you go to the Gates Foundation's website, all you see are these images of these nameless poor people, you know, mostly black and brown women and children smiling. You know, the message the Gates Foundation is sending is these are our intended beneficiaries. Look at all of these poor people of color that we're helping. But then if you actually follow the money, most of the money goes to rich nations. So the actual model of social change from Gates is not helping the poor, but it's helping the rich to help the poor. So it is a fundamentally colonial model that I think it does speak to certain prejudice or bias within the Gates Foundation that it really doesn't think that the global poor have the sophistication or the capacity or wherewithal, or will ever have the sophistication, capacity, or wherewithal to take care of themselves. It imagines a political future in which their poor will always be poor, but their lives will be marginally better because of the philanthropic endeavors of, you know, the richest people on earth, like Bill Gates and the Gates Foundation. So I do think there's something fundamentally colonial about Gates's model. And it's interesting in an area like global health or public health for poor people, there's now a kind of political or social movement trending under the hashtag of decolonize global health, where you have scholars and activists and practitioners who are challenging the sort of fundamental colonialism you see, not just within the Gates Foundation, but throughout global health. So that kind of political movement hasn't yet come fully to the doorstep of the Gates Foundation, but I think it does in many ways present an existential threat to the Gates Foundation's modus operandi and to how it does business.
And there is this really prominent example of the Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa, which the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation created. Do you think that this impacted the image of the institution itself because it was such a failure?
Did it impact the institution of the Gates Foundation?
The PR of the Gates Foundation, how people see the Gates Foundation, and maybe also, like, for the listeners who don't know about the AGRA, the background of this institution.
Well, yeah, let me just say, so it's been nearly two decades that Bill Gates said he was going to revolutionize African agriculture. And it started under this project called the Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa. And the model essentially was like the original Green Revolution decades ago, which bypassed Africa. And so Gates said, we have some unfinished business. We're going to take the same things that, as he sees it, made the Green Revolution successful elsewhere and bring them to sub-Saharan Africa. And this is mostly, you can think of it as industrialization. It's about the use of more expanded use of agrochemicals, especially chemical fertilizers. It's about the use of inputs where you're buying inputs from foreign manufacturers. It's about the use of high-tech new varieties of seeds. So Gates promised that this revolution would double farmer incomes, it would cut hunger in half, and it would dramatically increase yields, or would double yields. I don't know if he said double farmer incomes, but it was going to dramatically increase farmer incomes. So he had certain things that he promised that his agricultural development plan would deliver. And in the nations where the Gates Foundation's work, it has failed to deliver those. But more important than that, I think, is that you now have many farmer organizations across the African continent openly petitioning the Gates Foundation, asking it to stop its charitable crusade because it's causing so much harm and because it's standing in the way of better alternative pathways of agricultural development. You know, you have African farmer groups who are saying, we shouldn't be beholden and dependent on these foreign producers of agrochemicals for our farming to thrive. We should be able to use, you know, local knowledge and local solutions and locally produced inputs, you know, working through agroecology to expand and develop agriculture in the nations in which we work. You know, it is strange at a point when you step back, when you think about Bill Gates. He's this multi-billionaire in Seattle, yet he's managed to become one of the most powerful voices in African agriculture. You know, what does Bill Gates know about farming? You know, how does he become such a powerful voice and shaper of vaccine policy, of policy around contraceptive access, all manner of public education in the United States and elsewhere? Bill Gates is claiming expertise, claiming authority, using his wealth and power to try to remake all of these public policies according to his own narrow and often wrong-headed view of how the world should work. So it's a striking example of money and politics and anti-democratic power. And if we ignore this problem, the Bill Gates problem, you know, we're going to have a Jeff Bezos problem and a Mark Zuckerberg problem next, because Gates is now traveling around the world getting other billionaires to sign what he called the giving pledge, asking them to promise to give away most of their wealth to charity, to follow in his footsteps. So unless we deal with our Bill Gates problem, this is our political future, where climate change, artificial intelligence, public health, public education, immigration, all of these areas are increasingly going to be influenced by these obscenely rich men through philanthropy. I wrote the book about Bill Gates, but in a lot of ways, it is a case study for the problem of extreme wealth. When we allow people to become so wealthy, we know, you know, that's more money they could ever spend on themselves. There's so many yachts and mansions they can buy. So they will invariably use that money for political purposes, if not lobbying, if not campaign contributions, then as Bill Gates shows us, through philanthropy. And in many ways, of these tools that I just mentioned, philanthropy is the most problematic because it is so difficult to recognize as a tool of influence. You know, it's a billionaire giving away all of his money. How are we going to complain or criticize that? It also gets a great many tax benefits. So this is tax subsidized political influence. So I do think that it is a very serious problem for democracy that we should think about and we should address now and not later.
That's not a promising outlook, but it's a good ending for the podcast.
I do want to say, you don't think it's promising, but I do. Like myself, I'm inspired by the political change I see all around us. And this has been going on. This is not new either. You know, you have, look at Occupy Wall Street. Look at decolonized global health. Look at Black Lives Matter. You know, look at all these political social movements right now. The political will and the political culture is changing, and it's changing in a way that goes against the sort of oligarchical, plutocratic ethos that Bill Gates brings to the table. I think that his days as this kind of undemocratic, you know, wandering, unofficial diplomat, roaming the world and trying to shape government budgets and government agenda, I think those days are coming to an end. He's reached his zenith. And now really is the time where I think we can take a step back. But it's not just going to happen. You know, we have to be able to get past the political fatalism and to believe that another world is possible and to really fight for it. So, I do hope that this book that I wrote does send that message that another world is possible. It's there and it's worth fighting for and we should do it.
So we have a positive outlook and a positive ending. If you want to read more about the Bill Gates issue, then read the book from Tim Schwab. In German, also Das Bill Gates Problem. Thank you very much, Tim Schwab, for being on this podcast. It was a huge pleasure.
Thank you so much, Pascal. I appreciated it.
Das war das Interview mit Tim Schwab zum Thema Philanthrokapitalismus. Geführt von Pascal Sigora-Cliso vom Genethischen Netzwerk. Mehr zum Thema findet ihr in den Shownotes und auf unserer Webseite www.gen-ethisches-netzwerk.de. Wenn ihr Feedback für uns habt oder Fragen, schickt uns die gerne per Mail an podcast@gen-ethisches-netzwerk.de. Das Genethische Netzwerk ist ein gemeinnütziger Verein. Wir sind für die unabhängige kritische Arbeit, zu der auch dieser Podcast gehört, auf Spenden von Einzelpersonen angewiesen. Also, wenn euch die Folge gefallen hat, lasst uns doch als Dankeschön eine kleine Spende da. Das geht ganz einfach online unter www.gen-ethisches-netzwerk.de/spenden. Vielen Dank und bis zum nächsten Mal.